cannot play God, then wash your hands of the things that you've created.
Catapult the propaganda.
Military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I'm Sharon Gilbert, everybody. Welcome to, I think this is going to be an amazing interview. You want to get a cup of coffee and sit down for this one, folks.
Yes, this is going to range across a number of topics that we've discussed on PID Radio over the last couple of years. But our guest today is one of the foremost thinkers in this area. He's an award-winning author, attorney, senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he's been a regular guest, or at least a semi-regular guest, mm-hmm. on my radio program on the Eagle 93.9. Wesley J. Smith. Wesley, welcome to PID Radio.
Well, thanks. Hi, Sharon.
Hi, Wesley. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I've heard you on the radio with Derek a number of times.
Well, thanks.
And you're a regular guest of one of my favorite programs. It's Todd Wilkin over in St. Louis and Issues, Etc. And that's where I came to first be aware of your work and your ideas and thinking and writing on the subject of bioethics and this brave new world that we're moving into. Interestingly, Wesley's got a blog called Secondhand Smoke at his website, www.wesleyjsmith.com. His podcast, Brave New Bioethics, which is, again, a collection of his thoughts on these topics.
By the way, I want to, just for bookkeeping reasons, I want to say that we are recording this on Saturday, January 27th. So, Wesley, if you say anything that's really profound, that is actually futuristic, that takes place, we know what day we recorded it on.
That's right.
That's
so
right.
You can take
now,
credit
now,
on it.
My predictions will either fail or fall based on events.
We really are on the verge of some major changes in the state of humanity as a whole, and the transhumanism movement is right there sort of leading the charge. And Wesley, you've done great work in sort of tracking and documenting what these guys are up to. For people who don't know, how far along is the transhumanist movement right now, and what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, the transhumanist movement is not far along at all in terms of popular acknowledgement or even awareness. However, it is pretty far along in the sense of a very narrow band of elite people in the high academies, philosophers, bioethicists, and so forth, who literally are turning against being human and seek to create a post-human future. The real problem for me in terms of transhumanism isn't the technologies that they believe will one day transform human life into something utopian, such as being able to upload your brain or your mind, that would be, into a computer and live with in a group consciousness. That's just one aspect of transhumanism. But the values that they are espousing, and what I consider the nihilism, the misanthropy, the dark foreboding about humanity and the desire literally to escape it, I think is a situation that is of concern to all of us, or should be, and in fact can lead to the concept of a new eugenics, that is, of trying to improve the human race to a post-human state. We could end up actually denigrating and destroying those among us who are the most weak and vulnerable.
You know, I absolutely agree with you on that. When was I in school? My degree's in molecular biology and genetics, and it's from Indiana University.
Well, that means you're smarter than me, Sharon.
I don't know about that. When I was studying, I was an older student, so this was just about 13 years ago or so, and I remember it from my very first classes in genetics that we as students were asked tough questions that I thought were tough, actually, and they were really questions like, is it appropriate to create a being that is a clone simply to go to war and die?
Well, that's an important question.
It's an important question. We were asked questions like that on tests all the time. And essentially they were indoctrinating us into this sort of mindset that genetics was the future, and there was nothing wrong with reshaping the human body.
Do you think that...
What's really funny about this, and I don't mean this as a ha-ha, perhaps ironic would be a better word, is some of the people who are promoting this are really, really full-out materialists. That is, all they think there is, as I put it sometimes, is news, weather, and sports. And that the only thing that it's the religion of scientism, in effect, that is, science can tell us truth with a capital T, which, of course, is way beyond the what science really is about, which is a method of determining facts and how things work and then applying those facts to, hopefully, the betterment of humankind. But this idea of scientism or transhumanism as religion, that we can basically presume to play God or be gods and engage in intelligent design by people who think there is nothing but Darwinistic materialism in the philosophical sense, I find is profoundly ironic. The idea that there may be something bigger than ourselves, or that truth can be discovered through experience and through pondering, prayer, deep philosophy is quite often alien to them, and yet they believe they can obtain the very things that, for example, a Buddhist might search for in terms of a Buddhist contemplation and meditation through law technology, I think is very misguided, and I find it very sad, actually.
You know, it's very much like it's the Victor Frankenstein syndrome. You know, Victor Frankenstein has chewed any kind of religion because he didn't believe that God existed, and yet he sought to be God.
And the interesting thing is that it's the Frankenstein novel with the work often being done on the doctor instead of the monster. That's one thing that, and it reminds me of a joke, and I think I said this on Derek's show. Transhumanists say that we're not smart enough as humans, we're not strong enough, we're not beautiful enough, we're not virile enough, and it's all over so quick. It's like that joke in the Borscht Belt joke, and maybe it's a Woody Allen joke. One woman says to another, "How did you like the new restaurant?" And the other woman says, "Oh, it was terrible, the food was lousy, and they served such small portions." That's how I look at transhumanism. They're saying that everything about humanity as we are isn't good enough, and yet their desperate desire is for immortality. And then a side corollary of this is that having children ceases to be about loving children unconditionally and helping children to become who they are. Rather, it is about molding children and building children to satisfy the creators, if you will, to serve the creator's desires and fulfillment. So if I'm a frustrated baseball player and I want to have a kid who's a power hitter, rather than use my own sperm to create a child, I'll go buy some of Ted Williams' frozen DNA, clone the kid, and hopefully have a left-handed power hitter. But what happens if the kid wants to be an engineer? Do I send the product back as defective? I mean, this is crazy stuff. And I think it is a way of, it's an escapism. It is a way of not dealing with the more profound aspects of living, which is really to ponder, to pray, to find who we are, and to find ways to love and to serve. I just don't see transhumanism doing that. I see it as very solipsistic, self-obsessed, and always dissatisfied. And I find that very sad.
Is it, in effect, an attempt to achieve apotheosis through technology?
Well, you have to explain what apotheosis is.
Becoming God.
Becoming God.
I think that it's interesting, and there's an irony for me, too, here. Sometimes, you know, I promote the idea of human exceptionalism. That is, we should treat human beings as an exceptional species, which gives us special rights but also unique responsibilities. And one of the things that makes us exceptional is our capacities to do the very things that these folk desire. That is to literally recreate. We have stepped outside of Darwinian tooth and claw, at least one foot out, and instead of being molded by the world, we are actually able to remake the world, which makes us quite a, I mean, the only species in the known universe that can do that. Dinosaurs were on our planet for how many tens of hundreds of millions of years, and not one of them learned to play a musical instrument, you know. And so they want to, they embrace that aspect of humanity, while at the same time will say we're really not special. We're just like, you know, we're just meat on the hoof. And so there's a lot of dichotomy going on here and paradox. And this is a, as you pointed out, a secular religion. It is a way to try to be gods, not through a sense of worshiping the divine, and not in a New Jerusalem in the Christian sense, but in a materialistic sense. And it is doomed to frustration and disappointment. I was just looking, in fact, I just posted a piece on my blog, which I thought was somewhat relevant. There's been an anarchy riot in cyberspace. There's this game which I just heard about a week ago when somebody called to interview me about it, called Second Life.
Yeah, we've talked about that on my show, yeah.
Well, people lead, you know, if I'm a plumber and I want to have a white-collar job, maybe I can be a stockbroker. If I'm a lawyer and I want to have a job in which I, my adrenaline rushes more, maybe I become a cop or a soldier. And apparently, and I've never really known much about it, folks create these whole new virtual lives for themselves that they live. Well, according to this story, Le Pen from France, who's the far-right-wing politician, set up campaign headquarters in Second Life, and there were riots in cyberspace.
That's hysterical.
It is hysterical. And people were throwing, apparently, exploding pigs, and there was violence. And the point I made on my blog, and I just posted it when you called, is, well, this should tell the transhumanist something, because transhumanism is almost a second space kind of fantasy, and they think they'll be able to escape all the problems of humanity through technology, when wherever we go and whatever technology we are able to harness and however long we're able to extend our lives, I think at our essence we're going to be people. And so rather than spend all our time dealing with those issues, why not spend the time contemplating ourselves growing our more noble natures, or as Lincoln so beautifully put it, the better angels of our nature. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't require surgeries and implants and uploading. That requires humility. It requires love. It requires prayer, perhaps. It requires meditation, contemplation. And it requires the ability to not be solipsistic and think about me and start being a service-oriented person thinking about us, which really is one of the most important aspects of our truly human nature. And if we do that, much of what the transhumanists really yearn for, which is a better world of greater peace and greater fulfillment, can be achieved, I believe, in the here and now. And that's this escapism of Second Life and transhumanism. It's just a way of not actually engaging in the truly hard work, which was dealing in our own hearts and in our own souls.
Well said. Very well said. You mentioned something a second ago about going beyond humanism, which, of course, is what transhumanism is all about. We are in the midst of a sort of low-key redefining of what human is. So you can't even deal with transhumanism until there's a legal definition of what human is.
Yeah,
and as you know, we take it for granted. Well, human is human, right?
Right.
But we're getting to the point now where it's going to require a legal definition, because we find in the UK and perhaps other places as well, as of this day, I don't know for sure, that there is legislation pending that will say, okay, if your baby is born with this or that defect, then that baby really isn't quite human, so therefore we can go ahead and euthanize that baby.
Well, and you look at the philosophy that you see quite rampant in bioethics, secular bioethics, which is that being human is not what gives a being or an organism value, it's being a person.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to qualify as a person, you have to have certain cognitive attributes, such as being self-aware over time. And the transhumanists embrace this completely because, and I've been to conferences where these people really spend a lot of time worrying about this, that is, post-human rights. And because some of the transhumanists will not be fully human in the sense of biologically human, they want to make sure that post-humans receive equal rights, and therefore what they want to do is basically say that being human is not what creates moral value, but it's these attributes. And what that does in the real world, Peter Singer also, not in a transhumanist sense, but in his desire to be able to have infanticide and to increase the stature of animals, will say that, okay, there is such a thing as a human non-person. All unborn life are non-persons because they don't have these cognitive capacities. So are newborn infants, which for Peter Singer means that infanticide is perfectly acceptable because the baby isn't there, isn't of value simply because the baby's the baby. The baby is of value only if it serves the interests of the parents of that child, and if you extend his belief system, the society. People like Terry Schiavo say people who have lost those capacities would not be deemed persons because they can no longer exhibit those things. And therefore you see people in the transplant medical field and in bioethics saying, well, it would be perfectly acceptable, since they are no longer persons, to use them in medical experiments or to harvest them for their organs, because, you know, we reduce these human beings who are the most helpless and defenseless among us to the status of natural resources. Mm-hmm. And the question couldn't be more important, and this is how I think this is how I generally frame it. The question of the 21st century that is going to determine the morality in the coming century and beyond is, does human life have intrinsic value simply and merely because it's human life? And I'd say the only way to guarantee universal human rights, to protect the vulnerable and promote equality, is to say yes to that. And if we say yes to that, then we don't have to engage in subjective speculations, and we don't have to worry about the who matters and who doesn't matter being based on political power, which is what will happen if we say no to that. And so the question is, is being human matter? Does human being human matter anymore morally? And the second one is the issue you brought up. What does that mean precisely? You know, what is a cow that is a transhuman cow, meaning that it has some human genes and some human cells, does that partial humanity, that chimera state, does that change the nature of the cow? And what the posthumanists would say is, well, that means we do have to get into attributes to determine who or what is human and who or what isn't human. And if we continue down this basic Isle of Dr. Moreau kind of existence, they're right. We may have to engage in such activities. But in the meantime, and even then, there needs to be a complete wall up, a wall of separation, a no-man's land, where we do not apply those kinds of judgments to fully human lives, because that is a way to destroy full human equality. And if we have to start worrying about a part chimp, part human, which James Hughes, who's one of the leaders of the transhumanist movement, wants to literally create chimpanzees that can talk and communicate in that way, not because they would be of any greater value, but because, as he writes in his book Citizen Cyborg, it would be a way to prove to people that being human is not of intrinsic value, and that what matters is attributes. And this is profoundly dangerous, opens a whole new eugenics. And since I believe that the way we act really depends on how we define ourselves and how we perceive ourselves, if we perceive ourselves really as nothing special, as another animal in the forest, that's precisely how we will act. And we already have enough of a tough time. Take a look at the Middle East. Adding to the idea that being human in and of itself has no intrinsic value will only make things worse, not better.
You know, you were saying that the notion of personhood is rising above the notion of humanity. I would say if that's the direction they're going.
Yes, absolutely.
That you need not be organic.
That's exactly
the
point.
That's the transhumanist idea. The mm-hmm. transhumanist idea is, if we create artificial intelligence, mm-hmm. Then we will have to give personhood rights to these machines.
Well, exactly, and this whole idea of Second Life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you have a character within your Second Life that actually becomes a person, when actually the human sitting and creating it would not be considered a person.
This is where these folk want to go, and I think it's profoundly, and one level, the Second Life level, it's ridiculous. And on the artificial intelligence level, it's dangerous. It's dangerous because, first, creating artificial intelligence doesn't mean it's intelligent. It's still just following programming that humans created. And secondly, what makes us think we have the wisdom to decide these things? I mean, we're the species that created the unsinkable ship Titanic, for heaven's sake.
Well, you know, it's a funny little conundrum, because if Scientist A says, okay, humans are flawed, therefore we need to improve humanity, how can a flawed human do that?
That's right. And anything that, in fact, there is nothing in this physical universe that is perfect, and I don't think we'll ever achieve that. I'm not saying we shouldn't try to better ourselves. Of course we should, and we talked about that earlier. I'm not saying we shouldn't improve the health of the human race. Of course we should. I'm not saying that using technology to improve human performance shouldn't be done. Of course it should. But there are places beyond which we should not go, and that is messing with our basic biological nature and changing our understanding of the importance of being part of the human race. You go into those areas, and you're really looking for trouble.
Boy, that's the truth.
Wesley, what is the history of this transhumanist movement? When did this really begin to take root?
You know, I'm not 100% sure about that. I became aware of it when I was researching for my book, Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. And I think it is, I don't know where it started, but it's certainly generating, getting off on its up on its feet and generating more interest in the last 10 years. There's a fellow named Nick Bostrom, who I have met at one of these conferences, a nice enough guy, lives in a philosophical world completely alien to that which I inhabit. But he's been doing this at least a decade, and there's a World Transhumanist Association. People can look it up on the Internet. And it may have something of a history, but I would say people have been thinking about these issues. Well, clearly we've been thinking about these issues since Dr. Frankenstein and the Shelley novel, the eugenics movement, in a sense, was, while they didn't use the term transhumanist, was about perfecting the human stock. You get into some of the novels of the 40s and 50s, the idea, once we became as human beings capable of such astonishing technological advances, it was natural for people to start thinking about not only applying it to conquer the natural world, if you will, to make life easier, but to actually remake our own beings. But I would say transhumanism, that is the idea of creating a post-human future, has been, let's say, popularized, if not originated, within the last 10 years.
Now, I'm glad you mentioned the eugenics movement again, going back to the time of Shelley and Frankenstein. Is the modern transhumanist movement merely a repackaging of the same worldview that led to the rise of Adolf Hitler?
Well, I think we have to be careful when we invoke the H word, because it's a way people will say, well, wait a minute, these people aren't Nazis, and they're not Nazis. I would point out, however, that some of the worst things that were done in Germany in that era had nothing to do necessarily with Nazis, but with the eugenics movement, which literally rejected the idea of the intrinsic value of human life and saw the consequences of that. And we should also point out that the eugenic, or what were called racial hygiene laws in Germany, were inspired by our eugenics laws in the United States, particularly the California law. And here in the United States, we involuntarily sterilized between 60,000 and 70,000 people based on just quackery eugenic ideas. And this was approved by the United States Supreme Court in Buck v. Bell, 1927, in which Oliver Wendell Holmes, a eugenicist and a social Darwinist, basically said, quote, three generations of idiots is enough, and allowed this woman who'd done nothing other than to be born the daughter of a prostitute and to give birth out of wedlock, probably after she was raped by a foster family member, had her, she was sterilized for that because of supposed genetic defects, or what they call protoplasm, and imbecile by way of eugenic ideas. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. When we say, as the transhumanists do, that being human is not an essential attribute to moral worth, we do end up with terrible things. And it does. There are a lot of ways to fall off an ethical cliff than being the next Hitler. You see eugenics happening now in China. I believe the old Soviet Union did it. I do think it is safe to say and fair to say that these kinds of impulses lead to totalitarian desires, because even though the transhumanists say, well, this will all be laissez-faire, it'll be choice eugenics, once you accept the notion of eugenics, then those who are better not only want to be better, but they want to prevent the people that they consider dragging the society down from being able to exist at all. It's part of the human history. We've been doing this for thousands of years. This is just the newest approach to discriminating against others based on phony, subjective attributes that we decide to impose. Mm-hmm. And it's a way, in my view, of justifying going after the weak. Because in order to do that, we always have to make people less human than ourselves. Because we're ethical beings and have a moral nature, you'll notice that whoever we are, when we decide to go after someone else, we dehumanize them first.
There is a movement afoot in...
But to put it another way, if I might,
oh,
we
sure.
never go after us, we always go after them.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. That's Sociology 101.
Yeah.
Anybody who's ever taken sociology, sadly I did... Oh.
Transhumanism is literally about creating us and them.
Yes, that's exactly what it is. And along that same line, there is an elitist belief among some at the top who look at themselves and then at others and say, you know what, there should only be us and the rest of them should pretty much die. About 90% of them should die. They want to reduce the world population by about 90%.
Oh, now you're talking about the deep ecologists.
Mm-hmm.
And the deep ecologists are not transhumanists, but they look upon human beings as a vermin species.
Well, I would say if you took a look at them and then compared them to the eugenics movement, you would find an awful lot of people who share both camps.
Right, except I think that the deep ecology movement thinks of human beings per se, all of us, as a vermin species. And on the planet, what they consider the living organism, the planet Gaia, that is, mm-hmm. Earth is a living organism.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they see our vermin species having, remolded the natural world as a terrible thing. And they literally do want to reduce the size of the entire human population to, say, 500 million,
mm-hmm.
And get back to this kind of hunter-gatherer society situation, or perhaps even high technology. And of course, they see themselves as the ones surviving, of course.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a nature worship. It is a worship of the natural world. And that, of course, is also not new. It's funny that the people who are often claimed to be the most anti-religious are actually those that are most religious of all.
Yes.
That they are literally just worshiping a different aspect. They're worshiping the natural world rather than a Christian might worship the Trinity, the Lord, Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
They're not theistic. But they're trying to find, move past and beyond the physical world into the enlightened aspect where you become one with all. And Hindus having Krishna and others, the transhumanists and many deep ecologists just worship at different altars.
That is very interesting. And, of course, they would deny it vehemently.
Yeah, but see, they will say, well, we're not theistic. Well, that doesn't mean you're not religious.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You don't worship an outside God. You consider yourselves God.
Or you consider nature God. Transhumanism mm-hmm. has an eschatology where a new Jerusalem will be created, where people will have eternal life, only instead of being in a spiritual realm that is created by God, it will be in the physical realm that they will be able to manipulate and control. But it's no different than religion in the sense that got prophecies. They're looking forward in the transhumanist world to the day of the singularity, they call it. Kind of sounds like something out of the movie The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
But in the singularity, there'll be the sudden burst of increased intelligence. And again, a new world. This is a prophecy kind of situation.
Well, this just sounds like basic New Age.
Well, it, in a sense, I suppose, and I'm not an expert on various faiths or religious beliefs, but yeah, I think New Age, which was really big back in the 70s and 80s, and I even dabbled in a little bit, had to do it was very self-oriented. Yeah, you're right, and we will find the God within ourselves. Only the transhumanists would say we will find the physical immortality within ourselves, and we will strengthen those attributes which we believe are most important, generally intelligence physical stamina and ability to live forever. And the interesting thing is they rarely talk about love.
Hmm. And you know what is really interesting is you look at the attributes that the transhumanists want to enhance, you know, physical, but, you know, also the intellectual capacity through increased technology. It all goes back to the very first lie, ye shall be as gods.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think the human condition hasn't changed in that sense. I think we are who we are. And it just, the same, I think the same virtues and the same detriments keep getting recreated in new looks, but that's all surface. On the inside, at the heart of things, I don't think we've seen much change in recorded human history.
Hmm. Wesley, did you ever used to watch the television program called The Outer Limits?
Yes, I used to. I loved The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits.
Do you remember the episode called The Sixth Finger with David McCallum? His character was a little bit slow, but very, very kind and loving. And he was used by a scientist as the guinea pig for an experiment to undergo a machine that would advance him along the evolutionary scale.
Is this where he gets the big head?
Exactly, and he gains a sixth finger. But the interesting thing is, the more advanced, so-called, he becomes, the less humanity, the less loving he is.
That's an interesting point. You know, this is just Smith on this, and you know, anybody listening should take it for what it's worth. But some of the unhappiest people I've known about are intellectuals. Because I think that if we think that everything is in the frontal lobe, I think we can lose sight of a lot of essential aspects of our being. And knowledge isn't all. Knowledge is power, there's no question about that. But power isn't necessarily happiness, and power isn't necessary fulfillment. And that's why when I, getting back to the second life thing I blogged today, I kind of stepped outside of my usual discussions, which has to do with promoting human exceptionalism, the intrinsic value of human life, and got a little bit into areas which I tend not to get into, which is, you know, what's it all about, Alfie? How do we find meaning and purpose? And it, in my view, it isn't in exclusively the intellectual sphere. It certainly can be. I enjoy very much learning and reading and growing intellectually. But we're a species that is, I think, best off when we achieve balance. Balance in terms engaging and being humble, for example. Humility is a distinctly human attribute, which I think we need to work more on, because humility allows us to serve others and be selfless. And intellectualism, if it's just pure raw intellectualism, has a tendency, and I'm not saying intellectuals are this way, all intellectuals, but there's a tendency towards arrogance. I see it in myself. There's a tendency towards arrogance and the idea that being smarter means you're better. It used to be that if you had greater physical prowess, people thought they were better. But as how society works has evolved and changed, now I think there's this idea that if we're smarter, we're better. And I think we all have to work on realizing that we're all equal, and we have greater attributes or lesser attributes, greater talents or lesser talents. But if we can find that humility to understand that that doesn't make us better human beings or more important human beings in the metaphysical sense, shall we say, then I think we're in much better shape. That Outer Limits story is right. That's what was so good about those old Twilight Zones and Outer Limits. It wasn't mm-hmm. just futuristic. There were lessons for us to heed.
Mm-hmm.
I think Battlestar Galactica, as a current television program, is the best on TV because it actually also gets into these issues. What does it mean to be a human? The Cylons, who are artificial machines that were created to serve man, revolt
mm-hmm.
because mm-hmm. they consider themselves persons, and you even have the Cylons, these machines, who have developed religion. It's very, very interesting television, and I think science fiction is particularly good at dealing with this kind of thing because you can have people think about these issues without pounding them over the head with it.
Well, exactly, and there are times, frankly, when the Cylons appear to have more compassion
mm-hmm.
than
yeah.
the so-called humans.
So I think the Battlestar Galactica, the new series, which I really like, it also gets into these kinds of issues, and I think our entertainment medium is often a very good way to convey these thoughts, and Battlestar Galactica is a warning about the potential consequences of human hubris, and how eventually it comes back at ourselves and has the capacity to destroy us. Because we have taken that leap outside of evolution, and we can actually reshape the planet, the universe, eventually perhaps, or much, I mean, at least our corner of it, and we can make ourselves extinct. So that is this creates a very strong, requirement that we find the more humble aspects of our natures and start contemplating finding areas and the limits beyond which we just don't have the wisdom to proceed.
You make a good point, and I'm glad you brought up Battlestar Galactica and entertainment, how it's being used to, can be used to share ideas. For every show like Battlestar Galactica, though, it seems to us that there are a dozen that are actually promoting the idea of transhumanism.
Well, I think you see transhumanism being promoted across the board, not necessarily by that term,
mm-hmm.
but the idea that we can basically control, have hyper control over the environment and over our lives, is promoted quite a bit. And the idea of radical individualism, that is, that ceasing to see us as part of a community, and basically perceiving life as about, quote, choice, unquote, which, of course, is part of life, but it isn't the whole kit and caboodle. And again, I think the issue is balance. I'm way beyond my pay grade talking about these things.
Well, you know, you move in circles where people are talking about the ideas, the cerebral aspect of transhumanism. Where does it get into the lab, and how far advanced are they, do you think?
Well, we're really at the genesis, if you will. There are efforts underway to learn how to genetically engineer the human race, and right now most of the effort is therapeutic. That is, we want to be able to prevent some of the nasty genetic diseases that cause so much human suffering. But there are attempts to, and this is right now happening at the mind level or the definition level, which is also important, to blur and eradicate distinctions, for example, between the therapeutic and the enhancing. Let's say we want to do away with the gene defect that caused Huntington's. Well, that's a therapeutic thing, but a lot of folks would say, well, yes, but what difference does it make if we're trying to get rid of that disease versus trying to increase our ability to think through increased intelligence levels? That can be considered therapeutic, too. Or that which is now considered therapeutic and deemed enhancing because you are actually improving the quality of somebody's life by getting rid of these genetic defects. So there's a great effort underway to basically say that there's nothing can be defined, and if nothing can be defined, then anything goes, because there are no limits, there are no, we have no borders, we have no boundaries within which to work. In other areas of the transhumanist agenda, even the government is pushing and promoting some government studies of improving human performance. And if you look at some of the ideas that are expressed there, it goes beyond improving our performance levels to the idea that this will create universal peace and utopia. I think that the transhumanist element that is most dangerous is the utopian aspect of it, because we do all believe in improving human capacities, unless you're the Unabomber, which, you know, who became so anti-technology that he lashed out in terribly violent ways. But it's the idea that by improving our abilities, that we will somehow be better people and somehow change human nature, that I think causes difficulty. I think our better bet is to embrace our human nature and work on improving it in a human way, rather than thinking that there's going to be some miraculous technological fix, because there isn't.
Mm-hmm.
That riot in cyber world shows that.
But, you know, again, if you're going to make statements, and I agree with you totally, to approach it more from the human aspect, and of course I would go further and say, because I'm a born-again Christian, I would say approach it from a scriptural context. But let's just stick with the human aspect for now, and that is define humanity. You're going to have, we live in a sea of lawyers, and they want to define what that is.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. Actually, I was going to continue. We have a couple of friends, Paul and Philip Collins, who write from the perspective that we are entering a scientific dictatorship. And along that line, once again, when I was back in Bloomington, Indiana, we were encouraged, strongly encouraged, as future scientists to also consider going into politics. Because what we were told over and over again is, if you can control the legislature, then you can control the science.
There's truth in that. And the idea of having to define what's human, I mean, I often say, well, it's easy to define. And people will then email me back and say, you think there's something magic in 46 chromosomes. And I say, no, defining what is human is not difficult, it's easy. And the reason I'm in favor of that kind of, you might even call it mechanistic definition, is because then we don't get into what values more and what values less in human capacities.
And who gets to make those decisions?
That's right. We
yeah.
just know being human. Once you're part of a human family, you are a human organism. It's almost a natural law idea. You have a certain value that should not be violated. For example, to be used as a thing, as an object, as a natural resource. It seems to me that no human life, I don't care if it's an embryo or somebody who's on death's bed, should be considered anything other than a subject, because that leads us down these bad paths. In terms of science, there is a science that's becoming, it's being corrupted. Because it's ceasing to be about, in many regards, or in people's minds, how do we gain knowledge through that powerful scientific method and apply knowledge to science telling us truth with a capital T.
Mm-hmm.
And that's putting way more on science's shoulders than it is capable of producing. So we end up with people saying that something is scientific when it isn't. It's philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
That is philosophical scientism, which says that science will tell us, you know, we can create right and wrong based on what science tells us. But that's not based on what science tells us. It's based on our value system that we then apply to perhaps to scientific facts. And I think it's very damaging, because you do get into the concepts in the scientism view that human beings are nothing more and nothing less than another animal in the forest. And folks who embrace this kind of science will tell us truth with a capital T basically saying because we share a lot of genes with chimpanzees and other life forms, and because we all evolved purposelessly out of the primordial goo, then humans have no greater value than any other animal on the planet. And the funny thing is, they will want us to engage, and they will, they're denying human exceptionalism, but as they deny human exceptionalism, they claim that we have to act in exceptional ways, that is, sacrifice our own well-being for other animals because of our relationship to other animals. Well, I say, well, why should we do that? If we're just another animal, why shouldn't we just be in it for ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
Why shouldn't human beings in here in California, where the seals are basically destroying the salmon fishery for people, why don't we just go out and mow them down?
Mm-hmm.
They're competing with us for a vital food stuff. Sorry, that's my fax machine. They're competing with us for vital food stuff, which is becoming harder and harder to obtain, and it's causing rising prices and so forth. Why don't we just go wipe out the seals? That's
yeah.
what you would do in a Darwinian sense.
Exactly.
Exactly. I had that argument with my evolution teacher so many times.
You
can't call evolutionary pressure in one case and then, on the other hand, not admit that humans, as we are top of the food chain. And if we want to exert evolutionary pressure, it's up to us to do it.
And our exceptional nature says, no, we don't want to wipe out seals. In fact, not only do we not want to wipe out seals, when we find an injured seal on the beach, we take care of him and nurse him back to life, which interferes with the very Darwinistic natural selection process that we claim to embrace.
Exactly, which is
And so what happens is, we say, well, yes, we have all the obligations of human exceptionalism, that is, putting others first, including the environment and other species, and engaging in saving the environment, but we have none of the rights of human exceptionalism, because once we're talking about perhaps having a higher our rights having greater value than that of a squirrel, well, that's superstitious thinking, and we're just another animal in the forest. These guys want it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have to do is call them on it. If we're just another animal in the forest, then that should unleash us to do whatever we want with the environment to improve the human condition. They cannot have it both ways. And the global warming, well, if we're powerful enough to affect the climate, it shouldn't be to in a Darwinian sense, if we're just materialistic, why in the world should we say let's cut back on our activities that may hurt us economically to help the entire planet? Why don't we just make sure we prepare for the consequences that might flow from that, and to heck with the planet?
Right.
I mean, they want it both ways. And I think a better approach is to say being human is an exceptional thing. And that means we have exceptional rights, where the life of a human being is more important than the life of any other animal. That means we have rights to life, for example, rights to bodily integrity, that kind of thing. On the other hand, we also have exceptional duties because we can perceive things greater than survival and surviving long enough to send our genes down the generations. We know there's more to life than just the physical survivability of ourselves for as long as possible. And so we have empathy, which is a distinctly human characteristic. So we don't go out and kill all the seals. We try to save endangered species. Sometimes we go overboard with that, perhaps. But that is an aspect of ourselves. We're moral beings. No other animal on the planet are moral beings like we are. No other animal on the planet, unless they've had some association with humans, will actually sacrifice themselves for a different species.
Mm-hmm.
My dog, I think, would sacrifice himself for my wife and I. Now, whether that's because he thinks we're all part of a pack, or whether it's because, you know, dogs have been intelligently designed by humans. They didn't evolve. And the attributes they have of loyalty and of devotion were attributes that we created in them because we are an exceptional species.
I ran into a woman the other day who mentioned that she had not heard of transhumanism, this movement at all. And she's an intelligent woman. She's
Most of this gets down to the popular level. You know?
Right. And you mentioned at the beginning of the program, my question is, how influential are the thinkers in this movement within academia? How much of the debate are they shaping in the colleges that our kids are attending?
Well, I think they're growing in influence. that big conference I attended over 3 days was at Stanford. Nick Bostrom, who used to be at Yale and is probably the premier transhumanist academic, got a promotion to Oxford because of this. So these folks are at the highest levels of the academy, and these folks are influencing, and it's a slow process, of course, but they are influencing the generation of tomorrow, who will be the most elite in our society because they're going to the most elite universities. And I think it is part and parcel of almost a crass reductionism that sees humans as mere flesh and blood rather than more than that. And so I do think that you have a lot of kids who have not been raised to believe in something greater than themselves, who live in a relativistic society of choice, who look at this and see a way to achieve which I think is in a deep yearning in the human heart, which is transcendence. I think there's a deep yearning in the human heart for transcendence. If you look at the old cave drawings, which is incredible art, some of the art in the caves in France are as good as anything done in the Renaissance, you'll see that there's even then a sense of transcendence of half animal, half people. That implies strongly that there was a sense of spirituality then, of burying, even with the Neanderthals, is my understanding, burying like jewelry with them. What does that say? That says something very loudly about whatever happened in human history for us to become conscious. A Christian might say that God, breathed himself into humankind and we became made in the likeness and image of God. A evolutionary person may say, well, somehow through evolutionary processes we gained consciousness, which we don't yet fully understand. Well, with that gaining, apparently, we also gain not just an awareness of self, but a desire to transcend beyond self into something that is even more profound. That is really interesting to me. And whether that is the basis of religion or not, you see that desire of transcendence expressing in the Catholic Church, expressing in Buddhism, expressing in Islam, and expressing in transhumanism. We are looking for something more important, bigger, more meaningful than the brief parenthesis in time in which we are on this planet. Mm-hmm. And that is also part of the human condition.
And the basic difference then between how those searches are being conducted boils down to
how do we express that? That's right. Yeah. And I think it's even more powerful than the desire for physical survival. And for physical survival and wealth, we've had wars in all of recorded history. Most of the wars have not been about ideology until more recently. They've just been basically about, I want this property, I want these attributes, I want these resources so that my country and my tribe can have a better standard of living, and that's what colonialism was about. Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, we began to see these disputes being over beliefs, and of course we had that in the Crusades and in the Islamic invasions of Europe and so forth, but it's becoming more pronounced. Today we're far less about the kind of materialistic desire to grab land from others. And we're becoming more ideological, and our disputes are increasingly, I think, along those veins. And it may spring from whatever it is in us that seeks something beyond this pure physical world. My dog, wonderful dog, all he's thinking about is, when do I get my walk? Will the head of the pack, which is me, the alpha male, will he rub my tummy? And will I have a good dinner tonight? And he's a happy animal. He's not thinking about the bigger issues. Only humans can do that. We are transcendent. We are exceptional. And that gives us rights and it gives us responsibilities. And these are very profound. And this idea that of kind of trying to escape that while at the same time, exercise this escapism into post-humanity while at the same time denying that we are something special, it's almost nonsensical.
Mm-hmm. We're down to about our last 2 minutes here, Wesley. For people who want to read more about your work, or read your work, where do they go, and how can they get a hold of your podcast?
Well, my podcast, there's a link. It's called Brave New Bioethics, and it's on my website, which is now just it's a blog that changes every day, WesleyJSmith.com, www.WesleyJSmith.com. They don't have to worry about me pontificating too much like I was doing on this podcast. because mainly I comment on events of the day. I link to stories, and I try to promote human exceptionalism. I will also have a one-minute radio commentary that's beginning soon on a small radio syndicate in California that I hope to expand around. And on my blog, you can find links to the books. The one book I wrote that has a chapter dealing with this is called Consumer's Guide to a Brave New World. And there are also articles archives on my website where people can go into the articles archives and see if there's anything that interests them and take a look.
He's a frequent author of articles that you'll find at places like Newsweek, New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Forbes, Weekly Standard, National Review, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Wesley J. Smith, it's really an honor every time we get to talk to you, and always an education.
Well, the honor is mine, and I appreciate it very much.
Thanks for joining us. Hang on the line. We're just going to close out here, but we don't want to finish talking with you for a minute here.
Yes. Next week, we're going to talk with Sean Osborne. He is a military analyst, and we get kind of a unique perspective as far as the eschatology of the end times and how it relates to the political situation in the Middle East. He's a military analyst for the Northeast Intelligence Network. Sean Osborne, next week on PID Radio. Meanwhile, we welcome your comments at peeringintodarkness.com/forum.
You can always send us a note at radio@peeringintodarkness.com or at individually at sharon@peeringintodarkness.com or, guess what,
Derek@peeringintodarkness.com. Until next time, I'm Derek Gilbert.
I'm Sharon Gilbert. Bye-bye.
Next unexpected emergency? Lately, we have all seen how following a catastrophic event, stores will be closed, utilities will be unavailable, and emergency personnel will be tied up helping those most in need of immediate medical attention. The dramatic lesson is that you can't count on FEMA or other government agencies to be there as soon as you may need them. Even Homeland Security says that each of us need to take responsibility for ourselves and our own family's personal welfare. Now for the cost of a night out to dinner, an adult can survive for 6 days with a single survival kit. Available now at the Survivor Mall. TheSurvivorMall.com is your discount supplier of emergency survival kits, military gear and clothing, food and water rations, terror survival search and rescue supplies, and self-defense products. Visit the Survivor Mall at www.survivormall.com. That's www.survivormall.com. Don't live in fear. Get the gear.
Catherine Adamson thought she was going back to her quiet hometown of Eden, Indiana, to settle the affairs of her late Aunt Celeste. Instead, she discovers that Eden has literally gone to hell. Two high school students have disappeared, leaving behind only a running car and a bloody shoe.
Strange lights have appeared over the town, and the fields of a local farm are marked with blackened circles. Eden County Hospital reports record births, incredibly large babies joining the ranks of a growing number of giants. Many of Eden's leading citizens have been hiding evil secrets, but their behavior has been closely watched by the mysterious Dr. Apollo Bell, head of the Mount Hermon Institute. All of Eden is a war camp, and citizens must choose sides in an eternal battle. Catherine is reunited with her old flame, Joshua Carpenter, the publisher of the Eden Chronicle. They quickly learn their strongest ally may be John Thundercloud, a legless old Winnebago Indian who spends his days writing line after line in a library full of tattered diaries. It's Winds of Evil by Sharon K. Gilbert, book one of the Laodicea Chronicles. Available now online and at bookstores everywhere.